I am grateful today for the words of the New Testament scholar Matt Skinner, who reminds us that not every parable can fully represent the gospel, which, given this week's parable, is really good news. But as I've spent time with this parable this week, I've been wondering, why this parable? Why a story about a king's invitation to a son's wedding feast and the repercussions for not showing up? Why tell a story using this image, the feast, as its central image? Right? The feast has always been a biblical image used for a time when God shows up. And so I began to wonder, well, given this, how might this story change us? What might this story tell us? What might it mean to come close to a feast? And so, to come close this morning, I'd like to offer three stories of coming to the feast. Stories of invitation, of preparation, and of sacrifice. Last week, in this very space, or last year, we celebrated a wedding like none other I've been a part of. You may remember last May the wedding of Ryan and Don Young here at All Souls. And in many respects, it was like every wedding that I've ever done. It was beautiful. It was joyous, tear-filled. People had flown from around the world and walked from up the block to be here for it. It was two people who wished to live their love from God towards one another and said so publicly in front of hundreds. So far, not that unusual. But it was unusual in one particular aspect, the invitation. You see, in addition to sending out handsomely engraved paper invitations with envelopes on the day of their wedding, the wedding party got out and chalked the sidewalks of our neighborhood. And the sidewalk invitation said, "Come rejoice with us. Wedding at All Souls at 2:30. Come join the feast for blocks." It was one of the craziest, most inspired wedding traditions that I have ever participated in. Now, to be fair, they had centered their wedding feast around Luke's version of this parable, which had no throwing out of the wedding guests or any weeping or gnashing of teeth. That does change it a bit. But in both accounts, this same radical invitation remains. All are invited to the feast. Those who expected an invitation because of their relationship to the couple, and those who were just walking down the street. The good, the bad, those in between, all were invited to the feast. Now, I don't know if you've been to a wedding reception where this has happened, but the effect is kind of stunning. When the doors are open and anyone is welcomed in. And it has made me wonder ever since, right? Because Dong Young and Ryan actually live this way in their lives. They leave more room open at the tables they're a part of intentionally. And it's made me wonder ever since about the tables that I sit around. What is it like to approach a table knowing that there's more room? What is it like to approach a table knowing that you are welcome no matter what? What would it be like to make space for everyone around a table? How would that change what it takes to prepare? What might it mean to come close to a feast like this? And then, this is actually kind of funny, because I haven't revisited this particular memory for years, but in the midst of preparation for this sermon, suddenly it emerged. And you might think I would have thought about it every now and again, because it happened at the feast where Sarah and I were married, actually, more than a few years ago. And it just so happens that we had tied the knot and been blessed at the Little Red Church in Sonora, California. And we made our way to Sonora's historic opera hall. And the guests from near and far were all seated, and the food had been served, and the feast was in full swing. And I suppose that's what caught my attention, because there was one person who wasn't talking with anyone else. Right? It was a sea of storytelling and laughter, and he was an island unto himself. He was eating and he was drinking, but having nothing to do with any of the people around him. And since I didn't recognize him, I asked Sarah if she recognized him, which she didn't, and it's a little odd, you know, for the bride and the groom, neither to recognize the person at the wedding. So one of my friends went over to talk with him and ask him who he knew and what he was doing there. And it was really interesting. It was just like the parable. He was speechless. He had no answer. And eventually, he got up with a plate of food and departed, though not to the outer darkness. Instead, went right across the street. There was a bar right across the street, and that's where he went. And so I realized that, you know, there's the close parallel in the story. It's all about weddings and unlikely guests, and there's a clear parallel and all that. But the part that brought this memory to the surface for me wasn't necessarily any of that or even the wedding garment, but it was the refusal to join in the feast. Biblical scholars point out that in the logic of our narrative today, all the guests would have been able to put on their finest, right? They would have cleaned up in order to join the feast. But in this parable, this guest did not, chose not to. In the words of Richard Baucom, both good and bad are genuinely invited. Neither being good nor being bad is a qualification for being a guest. All that is required is that willingness to honor the occasion, to rejoice with the king, to be a real guest at the wedding, which wearing a wedding garment expresses. So this is after the invitation, and we've arrived at the feast, and we've come to the table, whether it's this table here, or when we're at dinner with a friend, or maybe a family member where things are tense, or maybe we're here around the tables that are open to our dinner later today. Really, any table where we find ourselves, I think this forces us to ask the question, are we there to honor the occasion? Does just being there count enough? Or really, are we asked to be present with who is there with us? What is being asked of us? What is it like to give all of ourselves for the people who are right here at hand? Not at hand, but at hand. Right? What might it mean to come close to this kind of a feast? It was a Lutheran colleague who first introduced me to an understanding of sacrifice that has changed the way I've lived. Because Brian Stoffligen has said that sacrifice is the act of giving something of value for the sake of something of even greater value. Now, I believe that our everyday usage of that word, sacrifice, often stops at the first part of that sentence, the part about giving something up of value. Now, rarely do we talk about sacrifice in ways that are hopeful or even life-giving. And yet, with true sacrifice, what is offered in return has greater worth, even if what we first have given means a great deal to us. Such is the thorny decision faced in this parable by the people invited to this wedding. Do I give up my time on the farm or in my business? Right? The Greek here shades in the direction of will and of want. If not just that they can't go to the wedding banquet. There wouldn't be much story there. It's that they don't want to. In essence, will I really get much in return? Is it really worth my Sunday morning or my Saturday afternoon or my Wednesday evening? Will I get anything back? Will I really know that I'm coming close? What might it mean to come close to this kind of a feast? This past week, I was part of a meeting at All Souls where we talked about the practice of giving. What messages we received about money and giving while we were growing up, and what it's been like as adults, and how that's informed us about what we give to All Souls. And one of the things that came up for several people is we don't like to talk about money in front of other people, especially. And so doing so at a time of year like this always engenders some really hard and challenging feelings for many. And one of the people there shared a story of when they began tithing or giving 10% of what they have to All Souls. It started 3 years ago when the Reverend Don Brown preached a sermon about tithing and added that we have a money-back guarantee. If tithing doesn't make your life better, the church will give you your money back. Now, this person had been thinking about it for a long time, but that served as kind of the final impetus. And so, for the first time in her life, she offered a tithe. And so, these are her words. In previous years, I approached setting my pledge amount through a complex formula. I based it on the principle that I wanted to give back to God in a way that I would notice and would feel recognizing, would recognize all the blessings in my life. I gave X dollars last year, and this year the budget is increasing by Y percent, so I should give X dollars plus Y percent plus 2%, since not everyone will be able to increase by Y percent. Does that total feel like a sacrifice? If not, I should increase it by another Z dollars, particularly if that makes a nice, easy number to divide by 12. Who has not been there? Pledging felt good, she said, but setting the amount felt like a complicated process that was actually fairly arbitrary. How do you measure blessings anyway? I decided to try tithing that year. It honestly has been an experience that feels like moving away from arbitrary rationalizations into freedom. It's become, for me, a measure of faithfulness and nourishment. I am nourished by the experience of being faithful through tithing. The amount is much less important. The practice is one that feels like a blessing itself. The amount is much less important. The practice is one that feels like a blessing in itself. For her, the practice of tithing, of giving away 10% of what has been given her, has been liberating. It has come from this paradoxical sense of sacrifice. Giving of value, something that really matters to you, or something of even greater value. Now, this is a practice that Sarah and I have kept ever since I began my life as a priest, and it's been something that I have felt as well, the sense of liberation. There is a really strange and unexpected joy and a sense of release that can come from it. And it's as if the power that money has, the shroud that it casts around us, kind of can be pierced, broken open. First, when Sarah and I started this practice, it was a challenge to see what habits we would change and what we might give up for this to be. But over time, it has been this remarkable spiritual practice, and every time, the 10% is not, well, it definitely has a numeric value. The 10% stands in so we can remind ourselves of where the 100 came from, what we've been given, and what we are to do with it. And so, as in past years, this year, All Souls is very generous in paying salary that All Souls is paying me, $105,000, we are giving $10,500 to this parish. And I don't say this to boast in any way of either number, just to say this has been the practice of liberation for us. It is free. It is a gift that we freely offer, knowing, trusting, that it is through this community that people inside and outside of these copper doors are being transformed. It's through joyful celebration and prayerful stillness people are coming closer to God. It's in times of crisis and loss when people are met with presence. It's in acting with whole hearts inspired by the Spirit when people walk alongside those in hunger and fear and addiction. And it is a gift that we freely offer, trusting that there is more to be revealed. Gift we freely offer, wondering for ourselves, for all of us, for all of this community, for this world, wondering what might it be like